Fine Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. I need to prepare you for some things that are going to be happening on our show today. We're going to talk a little bit about seasons and a little bit more about seasons. A couple of things happen this time of year that sort of usher us towards a new set of seasons. We're in hurricane summer. We're in the midst of hurricane summer. And it's one of these great transitional times, but it's a time of planting. We try to encourage you to do that. I hope you've done it. Boy, I hope you have. If you don't know what to plant, you give me a call. Let's talk about it. There's still a lot of time to plant some things. Still a lot of time to catch up. It's the time to start transplanting things to the garden. But let's talk about why for a second. There's a couple of things that happen. One, there's a temperature transition. And we're already getting it. I think the satsumas are going to be particularly good this year because we did have that little break in temperatures that you need to make really good satsumas. And as John Olive always reminds me, that break needs to occur not just in October and November, which is important. That break in temperature needs to occur in September. And it occurred this year. It's been pretty good. I think we had a little break, just a little bit of decline in those night temperatures. Doesn't matter about the daytime temperatures. What matters is the nighttime temperatures. They're declining. That's pretty nice. That's pretty good. Whew. That happens. But there's another thing that happens, and it's really important. It's happening this month. Day length is declining. I mean, I can't tell you how many days I've been out working in the yard, in the garden, on the farm, and boom, there it is. It's dark. Where did that come from? I'm used to working till 8 o'clock. It happens. The days are getting shorter, and that has a lot of effect. The days are going to get shorter and shorter and shorter. This is the time of year when the daylight in Alabama is going to be roughly equal to the average daylight at the equator. That's pretty important. This is the time when we're tripping over, and then it's going to get shorter and shorter until the days are shorter than the days at the equator. And that has a lot of effect on a lot of plants. Poinsettias, things like poinsettias from subtropical areas. Their blooms are initiated. They're Mexican plants. Their blooms are initiated when days get to a certain length, when they get short enough to initiate bloom. That signals a lot of things for plants in subtropical areas. So that's one of the things that's going to happen. You're going to remember that with melatonin. But you know what else these short days begin to do? There are a lot of plants in Alabama that are responding to that right now. And so I want to talk about fall color. Now, I know what you're used to thinking about when you talk about fall color, because we borrow our language from really, I shouldn't say it, boring places like New England. I'm sorry, folks. That don't have many seasons, that have a very constrained season where they... And so everything, you know, so what they celebrate when they celebrate fall color is dead color. The colors of things that are dying and dead. And that's okay, because it's New England and you got to celebrate, right? Something. But here's the thing about the South. Fall color in the South is beginning now during hurricane summer, and it will accelerate through October and into November. And yes, there are some great leaves that are going to be turning. There's some great leaves. The black gums are already turning. If you look in the right places, the buckeyes are already turning. You're going to see some of that color. But here's the real thing. It's the living color of fall along the Gulf Coast that's really interesting right now. What am I talking about? I'm talking about this is the big season of wildflowers. They are everywhere. I want you to look for them. I want you to see them. I want you to go out and look for them. You know, it's getting harder and harder the way highways are maintained and the way suburbs have taken over country areas and the way houses and golf course lawns have taken over rural areas to see this color, but it's still out there. I'm seeing it everywhere. Look for those fields that are alive with color right now. You won't believe the colors. They're so intense. They're so beautiful. They're so incredible. It's part of our fall. What's out there right now? I don't know where to start. Helianthus, the sunflowers are everywhere. You know, I want to tell you, Alabama, and somebody prove me wrong, please. Alabama is the global center of sunflower diversity. There are 50-odd species of sunflowers in the world. Something like 26 of them, 27 of them maybe, are native to Alabama. It's incredible. You can go into fields in Alabama where you might see 6 or 7, 8 sunflowers in one small field. It's incredible. Sunflowers in Alabama are all size. Sometimes they're pretty large. They're not the size of the cultivated ones that people have in their yards. That was a native one from North America, too. But it was an annual, the annual sunflowers that people plant from seed. They've been sort of meddled with to give them that big flower. But we have all sorts of native sunflowers that are perennial, that come back every year, that you don't have to replant. And they are golden right now. They are beautiful. They're everywhere. They're just incredible, along with the silphiums. And we should talk about silphiums. Silphiums and sunflowers can be a little bit difficult to tell apart, but boy, if we didn't have enough sunflower diversity, the silphium diversity, which are somewhat similar, is even greater right now. Look for those things on the side of the road. If you don't know, if you're wondering, well, God, what does a sunflower look like? Well, you know, like annual sunflowers have that big disc in the center with yellow petals, our native sunflowers are the same way. It's just that the disc in the middle is not as big, smaller, and the petals, the yellow petals, are not maybe, well, they're often as long as the annual sunflower petals. It's that disc in the middle that's doing all the business, by the way. The sunflower is incredible. The ironweeds are absolutely stunning. If you haven't seen that purple of ironweed, it has got to be one of the most incredible purple colors you've ever seen. There is no purple in the world that compares to that purple. I mean, LSU purple, sorry, folks. Ain't nothing compared to ironweed. Maybe that color derived from what's happening, the LSU colors of purple and gold, David, you can tell me. Maybe it derived from fall in Louisiana rather than something like Mardi Gras. I'll let you decide. But the ironweeds are absolutely incredible right now. The goldenrods, you have no idea how many goldenrods there are out there right now. No, they don't cause hay fever. And they're absolutely stunning. They're everywhere. Just take a look at them. Look at the different kinds of goldenrods. Some of them are flat-topped. They will actually be yellow. Our flat-topped goldenrods are everywhere. Some of them will have long, thin spikes that are just beautiful. I love that spiky goldenrod on the Gulf Coast, the coastal goldenrods. I love the big, fluffy goldenrods. They're absolutely incredible. Just take a look at them, the asters. Do you know what the asters are doing right now? Those beautiful asters that, you know, people go to get mums at the, at the Lowdown Depot. But the colors of the asters in the wild right now just blows those colors out of the water. The most incredible blues, some of the deepest purples I have ever seen in asters. Out there in the field right now, the white asters are just beautiful. All types of asters blooming right now, right now. Incredible things. The false foxgloves. You're going to see them everywhere. What's a false foxglove? Go look through the fields. You're going to see. You can stick your finger in the flower. You can. Some of them you can only stick your pinky in. Some of them you can stick your thumb in. Man, what color. Lytris, the partridge peas, the blazing stars, the deer tongues, the eupatoriums, the blue curls. It just goes on and on. This is the season of color along the Gulf Coast. Don't miss it. You call me if you want to find it. We'll be back.
Because everything is on the phone, you know you got to go. I'll get down on your bending knee.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yeah, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Let's see, we got a lot of questions coming in this morning. Just take a look. And you might have to get off the interstate. You may have to go to places like Point of Pines, which is going to be really nice here very soon. The butterflies are going to be incredible. You might have to... I had to go to a native area. You know, Blakely used to be really good for these asters. I would go, I remember I did a class years ago at Blakely, and there were six or seven asters that I could show people in half an acre. It was unbelievable. Kogon grass and some other things, disturbance have sort of wiped out a lot of that at Blakely. But if it's still there a little bit, and I still think you can find it, and I still think you can find it in other areas in Baldwin County and in Mobile County, it's just unbelievable. It was in every type of habitat. It's in the Delta. The Delta's not that diverse in terms of plant life. I know that you've been misled to believe otherwise. It's not. But it's got some good things going on there right now. But the big stuff is in the longleaf pines. That's where the real diversity is. And if you can find some old longleaf pine habitat in North Baldwin County, if you can drive along some of those roads where the suburbs haven't taken over, it's absolutely incredible. It's absolutely incredible what's there. The wildflowers are just stunning. Splinter Hill is very nice right now. You wouldn't believe the number of sunflowers. You wouldn't believe the liatris and the deer tongue and all of its relatives. All of these things that are blooming right now, just incredible at Splinter Hill and other places. Encourage you to take a look. It is our fall color. It's our fall color. So we're getting some questions, and I'm going to try to answer them here real quickly. Let's see. Where are we starting? Michael sent me a picture. Yeah, that's a Biden's. I think that is one of the invasive Biden's, probably Biden's alba, which is sometimes known as beggar's ticks. I think this one's from South America. I'll look at it a little better, but I'm pretty sure, and I'll tell you for sure. But I think that's probably Biden's alba, however you want to pronounce it. What's sometimes called the white aster. But we'll take a look at that real carefully on our next break to make sure. Crystal sent me a great picture of the butterflies on the Tithonias that she planted. Tithonia is not a native plant, the Mexican sunflowers, but boy do the butterflies love it. And one of the things that happens, of course, with all these wildflowers is that the butterflies just flock in. They know this transition's happening. They see it happening. They're coming in. They're moving southward now. And we're going to get a greater concentration. You're going to see them out all the time. David asked me a good question. Where do you get seeds for Alabama wildflowers? Alabama. And you're going to have to get them in wild places in Alabama. That's just the roadsides are good. I mean, don't overcollect, I suppose. I don't think you probably will. Here's the thing. We are not entrepreneurs of our own diversity. We have never capitalized on that. We've never wanted to. No one's doing it. My good friend Jan Midgley, she's gone now, gone from Alabama. She did it a little bit. You occasionally can get, but no one was really working to provide Alabama seeds to Alabamians. And Alabamians are going to say, oh, what's at Home Depot? Well, Home Depot's not going to give you Alabama seeds. Why would they do that? They want to sell to New Jersey. They want to sell to Michigan. They want to sell to places that have lots of money and lots of people. We don't have either, really, in Alabama. So we kind of get the hand-me-downs. We got enough that they can build a shop around, but not enough that they can actually devote real attention to in terms of they're not going to provide you seeds. It's always been on Alabama to provide Alabama seeds. And I'm working on it as fast as I can with several other jobs. Maybe one day we can do that. But you know, Alabama is so big, it's almost like there needs to be several people in several parts of Alabama providing seeds. And that's, I can't tell you, David, I wish I could. But it's not there. It's not there. And it doesn't mean the diversity's not there. It is. It doesn't mean that it's not great to be able to get those seeds and that you'd be, you would be. But we don't cater to ourselves. We don't cater to our place. We don't even appreciate our place the way we should. And if we did, we would be collecting seeds. We would be making them available. So here's the thing. What do I do about that? How do we help? One is, you can find seeds for a lot of these plants just yourself. It's really incredible. And I encourage you to go out and look and take pictures. Bring them back to me. And I could tell you what you're looking at in most cases. And we can see. And you can gather those seeds yourself. Now, you know, you need to know a little bit about when seeds mature. If the plant's in full flower, the seeds are probably not mature yet. If some of the flowers on the plant have begun to dry out, those seeds are probably mature. One thing you can do, if you care about it, and if you care about Alabama, and if you're excited about it, you can do what I do. You can identify plants on the roadside and say, boy, that's got some incredible flowers. Let me just mark where that is. You know, they have these GPS points now. They're absolutely incredible. You can actually just say, oh, this is 100 yards from the old church on such and such a road. I'm going to come back and collect the seeds when they dry out. You can do that. So it's really fun. Send me pictures if you want to know about what you're looking at, whether it's native. We're happy to figure that out. We're happy to make that work for you the best we can. And then you can collect the seeds, and it's a great way to do it. It's fun, and there's some incredible seeds out there, incredible things out there. Don't overcollect seeds. There are a lot of people who who go to places like pitcher plant bogs. They trample them to pieces. And they collect way too many seeds, and then they find out, oh, I can't grow these. They don't grow in my yard because I don't have a pitcher plant bog. And then we've kind of wasted all of those seeds. That's not a good thing to do. But along roadsides, it's pretty safe. It's pretty safe. You're not going to do a lot of damage. You know, grasses are absolutely incredible right now. Look, folks, just look for split-beard bluestem. I want you to look for it. It's so cool along the roadsides. It's one of the most beautiful grasses you've ever seen when it's in bloom. It's got these the stems. It's hard to describe the color of the stems right now. It's just absolutely beautiful. The flowers have these beautiful white, silvery flowers at the tips that are split sort of in a V. They lean over. They get fluffy. The whole plant is just a beautiful explosion of colors right now. Really great. What a great thing. What a great thing. David is sending me pictures of the passion flowers that are out there right now. They're getting eaten alive, and that's exactly what should happen with the Gulf Coast fritillary. I can see the mother fritillary, and I can see lots of caterpillars that have hatched and are eating those passion flowers. It's an old cycle, a beautiful cycle. Dan wants to know whose tithonias are bigger. It's hard to tell. They're both pretty big. Dan, your yellow flower that you're sending me is Coreopsis. It's Coreopsis major. What's a good common name? World tick seed. World, because if you look, WHORLED, whorl, the leaves are in a whorl around the stem. World tick seed, Coreopsis major. Beautiful thing that's blooming now. We got lots of other things. Ooh, and what's that legume? I'll try to figure that one out. We'll be back. Give us a call.
My girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night? Come on, tell me, baby. In the pond.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Welcome back, Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Lots of questions this morning. It's good. This is good. Dan sent me pictures, so we got the Coreopsis down pretty good. Dan, the that orchid-like flower. Dan sent me a picture of a flower that he describes as orchid-like, and it's pretty spectacular. It's not huge, but it is incredibly colorful. You could see it from a long distance. The flowers are really nicely displayed, and they're just this incredible pinkish purple. And then if you get up close, it looks like it has these little green eyes with the outline in red right in the middle of this sort of weird-looking pink face. It's really quite spectacular. It's a legume. It's a member of the bean family. It's not an orchid. It's a member of the bean family, and it's probably, I'm pretty sure, it's one of the desmodiums, what we call, what's the name, beggar's lice. You know those little things that stick tights, that stick to your pants when you walk through the fields in fall? Have you ever walked through a field in fall? And you get those little things that stick to your, flat things that stick to your pants? That's one of the great, I should have even mentioned these as one of the great colorful wildflowers of fall. They really are spectacular. And we have a lot of different ones. We've got a field that's just covered with them now. Just unbelievable. And yeah, you know, they're going to be all over the dogs. Can't help it. It happens. They get all over the dogs. Things could be worse. These plants, those beggar's ticks, sort of remind us of what the South was like when humans first got here. Because those plants are designed to be carried around by big fuzzy animals. And it would have been carried around by the big fuzzy animals of the day, the horses. The native horses of Alabama, the stilt-legged horses, for example, that were so cool-looking with their little delicate mule-like feet and their big, fat bodies, big, massive bodies. Not fat, massive. Big-headed, beautiful things, the stilt-legged horses. The camels that were so much a part of our world here. I mean, this is where camels originate. All these things. The elephants. All of these things. Yeah, we had elephants. All these things would have been carrying these beggars' lice around. They sort of evolved to do that. It's kind of fun to think about that when you pull them off your pants legs. They kind of, you know, it's just by happenstance that they used to could fit onto hair. Hairy legs, now they're fitting onto our pants legs. They're really cool, but they're absolutely beautiful. Great legumes, great for pastures, great forage, by the way. Great forage. Beautiful things that are out there right now. Let's see what else we got. Let's see. Talking about purple, hard to beat beauty berries down here in Irvington, Jim says. Yeah, you know, I 100% agree. Calocarpa is beauty berry is really widespread. It really has all kind of great uses, and I don't think we even realize how useful it is. It is a bit weedy. It comes up a little bit everywhere, but I can't really fault it. If you've seen those berries wreathing the stem, I mean, it's just like, how do I describe that? It's just absolutely gorgeous. Beauty berry, what a stunning plant. What a beautiful plant beauty berry is. It's just incredible purple. Thanks, Jim, for reminding me. One of those other great colors of fall. Now, this is great. Laura Scherer sent me a picture of what's called locally wild basil. Wild basil. It used to be Sataragia coccinea. I think it's now Clinopodium coccinea. It's one of the great native mints. Isn't that beautiful? It's just an incredibly stunning plant. It's part of the longleaf system. It's part of the great collection of things we've got going on right now. She got it off. She found it on the side of the road, dug it up. But you know what? You don't have to dig this plant up. You don't have to dig it up. You can collect the seeds from it. When you see this beautiful, beautiful, big red flower with the open mouth, just brilliant red, you send me a picture if you're unsure about it. It's our wild basil. Just collect the seeds. Collect the seeds. It's going to be hard to dig up some of the wild plants. Laurie got lucky, but it's a beautiful plant. Wild basil, Clinopodium coccineum, I believe, is where we've left it now in Latin. Wild basil, there ought to be another name. Red wild basil, something. It doesn't really look like basil, but it has a great fragrance, and it's a member of the mint family. Beautiful thing, part of this color of fall color. Hurricane summer color along the Gulf Coast. Yeah, Calocarpa. So somebody sent me a Dan sent me a picture of massive bushes of Calocarpa. Really beautiful. Dan is punishment for that. Not as punishment for that. As a reward for sending me that picture of Calocarpa. You need to go back and figure out what type of Desmodium you were looking at. What type of beggar's lice you were looking at. What type of sticktite you were looking at there in that preserve. One of the things you can do to help me is to take pictures of the whole plant and the leaves. If that flower was on that Desmodium, on those beggar's lice, if it was just that looked like an orchid, just spectacular little flower, if the flowering stalk had no leaves on it whatsoever, if the flowering stalk had no leaves on it whatsoever, I can tell you which one it is pretty quickly. Let's just tell me and give me a sense of what the leaves look like, and some other things, and we can figure out exactly which Desmodium that is. I think just need a little bit more of a picture to get me started. So somebody sent me a picture. Somebody sent me about a site for native seeds. Roundstone seeds, yes. Now, one of the... and native where? That's the question. So, listen, if a plant is native in Michigan, is it native in Alabama as well? No. And this is a mistake we've made a whole bunch. This is a big mistake we've made. Even within species, what we call species, because we're making species up as we go along. You know that, right? We're doing the best we can. But species don't have labels. They didn't come with labels. In fact, Genesis tells you, God didn't put any labels on plants. That's what Genesis says. Didn't put any labels on things. That was your job to figure it out. So we're always trying to put names, but sometimes we don't even capture the diversity within species. And there is a ton of diversity. A plant, let's say a grass, let's say something like, there are a few plants that grow in Michigan. Let's say we've got a sunflower in Michigan that may be the same species as the one here in Alabama. There aren't many up there, but there are a few, like Helianthus divaricata. That it's going to be, the plants up there are not going to be at all adapted to conditions down here. Mountain laurel is a great case. If you try to take mountain laurel from the mountains and move it down to South Alabama, it's not going to do well for a lot of reasons, but particularly because it's just not well adapted to this heat. However, if you get mountain laurel from the streams where it's been here in Mobile and Baldwin County longer than it's been in the mountains, and there are streams here where mountain laurel has been here for much longer in Alabama than it's been in the mountains of North Carolina, many places, those plants are going to do well here. So one of the problems with the national seed sources like Roundstone is that you don't know where those seeds came from. And you're not sure they're going to be well adapted. So just be cautious. It's dangerous to take shortcuts sometimes. You don't know what's going to happen. I just recommend that you use caution. You use caution. Let's see here. What else we got? Passion flower growing just absolutely beautiful. And what is that caterpillar? I guess it is a fritillary. It's one of the northern fritillaries caterpillars, not the Gulf Coast. Looks like maybe the big fritillary that is in North Alabama. Looks like that caterpillar. They both feed on those passion flower vines. Just absolutely beautiful. Let's see here. Michael Neal sent me another picture. Michael's going to keep me busy this morning. Michael, that last picture you sent me below the Bidens, below the beggar's ticks, the last one is a sunflower. And it's quite conspicuous. It's one of the smaller flowered sunflowers. I'll have to think about which one it is. It may be, and I'll have to look carefully. Well, it's hard to tell, isn't it? Because I can't tell the size of the flower. It could be Helianthus resinosus, because I see those bracts bending back a little bit. It could be Helianthus hirsuta, the hairy sunflower. It's going to feel a little bit hairy, I suspect. I'd have to look carefully, but that is definitely a sunflower. It's definitely one of the sunflowers. And you just, sometimes with some of those sunflowers, you have to use a microscopic key, or you have to be able to tell the width of the flowers. That's fair, isn't it? But it's a sunflower. How's that? All right, we're going to be back. Give us a call, 251-343-0106.
Put it in a big brown bag for me. Sail right round all the seven oceans. Drop it straight into the deep blue sea.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, that's enough. That's enough. We got business. So, thank you. No, please. Joe, get us off this. Let's change the subject. Joe, you ought to fuss at me for not getting to you sooner, and I apologize. I missed that. Are you still there? Joe? Maybe we missed Joe. Yeah, sorry about that. Joe, give us a call back. I apologize for not getting to you sooner. A couple of questions to sort out here. Johnny's sent a great picture of his sweet oranges. I don't know which variety, but boy, they're looking really good. It was a good winter for it, I think. And so we're going to have good crops of citrus right now. Somebody asked, can we grow saffron here in Alabama? No. And let me just think about it. And it's worth thinking about. It's not always. We have a tremendous amount of diversity here in Alabama, and we should learn it, and we should take advantage of it. It's not always a bad thing to import plants from other places. Not always. You should be careful about it. But when we're looking for things that can grow here, like, why would you go to... Wouldn't you look for plants that are from a similar climate? And we don't do that because we're still very, how do I say this? Even if we're not from Europe, we still think as if we live in Europe. And it's kind of weird. When somebody thinks about herbs, we think about, what are the herbs that they use in Mediterranean countries like Italy and Spain? But you know what? Those places don't have a climate like ours. Mediterranean climates are known for their dryness. Crocus is native to, one of the places it's grown, well, I think it's probably native, Spain. And Spain, I don't know if you've ever been to Spain, but Spain is pretty dry during the summer. It is the absolute exact opposite in many ways of Alabama. It is extremely dry during summer. Some places are wet during the winter, and that's when the crocus grows, and they're moist during the winter. But it's a period of rainfall, typical of Mediterranean climates. But they may only be getting, they're probably only getting, in most places they're growing crocus, they're probably not getting even a sixth of the rainfall that we get in Alabama, or a fifth. It's really that different. It's very different. Will crocus, no. Crocus will not grow here. They're bulbs designed for very dry climates, and they won't grow here. So it's useful to think about that. That's a simple answer. Crocus are not going to grow here in any way. But there's so many other great herbs. And think about there's a world of herbs out there from South America, from Central America, from Asia. Things like gingers are incredible. We can grow gingers very well because they're from wet climates like ours. And they do well for us. So it's sometimes good to think about that, and to think about some of our native herbs as well. Basil is another one of those great herbs, and even though we think of it as coming from Italy, it doesn't come from Italy. It comes from India, and it comes from China. It comes from Asia. It comes from those areas. It was imported into Italy just like tomatoes were brought to Italy from South America. Yeah. Did you think about that? It's kind of weird, isn't it? And they can grow those well enough there. But really, basil does well for us It's from a wet area. It loves our wet summers. It does really, really well for us. Probably better for us than it does in Italy. Interesting. Yeah, I love, somebody sent me a great picture of a praying mantis. They are so cool. They're so beautiful. One of the really cool things in life are praying mantises. Just a beautiful thing. David P., we got off on getting native seeds from Alabama, and hiding under that question was another question from David. Is this the right time of year to start thinking about blueberries again? It is the right time to start thinking about them again. I would plant them in mid-October or later, but sometime between mid-October, if you water, you can plant them now if you water them very carefully. David, you can plant them right now, but just make sure you water carefully. If you're not going to water frequently and carefully right now, which this is a good time to plant, but if you're not going to do it now, wait until mid-October. And then you can try it, and you won't have to, you'll have to water them in real good. You might have to water once or twice a week, but the temperatures will be cooler. The plant will adapt a lot easier without as much attention if you wait until a little later. Anytime between October 15th and the 1st of December is a great time. Great time to plant those blueberries. I highly recommend that you think about doing that. The October 15th is a little better because it's going to do a little bit more root development while the ground's still warm, but you're going to be good. You just peg October 15th to sometime around the 1st of December. Excellent time. You can still plant through December, but I'm talking about the prime time. There you go. It's so much easier to start things like blueberries in fall. Most plants, most woody plants, you really want to start them in fall. Citrus are the one exception. But start them in fall. They'll do a ton of root growth. They'll have an easy time over the winter. They will ignore the fact that you're bad at remembering to water. There it is. Now, that doesn't mean you should, if you can remember to water, that's great. You should. But we forget, and they won't be so bothered by it because there'll be plenty of moisture available through the winter. As temperatures decline, as we get more rainfall, there it is. So that's good. Listen, we're going to be back with another hour. My good friend and companion David Hubble will be back with us. We're going to talk a little bit about a few odd things. Some things we've talked about before, melatonin, and some things we haven't really talked about before, which is going to be fun, which are freshwater shrimp and how we lost those. That's going to be a lot of fun coming up in our next hour. We're also going to continue to talk about fall color for the Gulf Coast. So you feel free to give us a call. We're going to have a fun hour next time. 251-343-0106 is the place to call. Yeah, and we're going to be back. Let's talk about those sourcing Alabama native seeds when we get back.
There's a fly in the window.
gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. It is a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. And the wildflowers are rising all along, all in Alabama. It's the shorter days that make a difference. You know, plants, it shouldn't surprise you. Plants look at the sun. They are photosynthetic. That is their world. I mean, they make their living. They make their living. This is really important if you don't understand this. They make their living looking at the sun. They don't make their living with fertilizer. Fertilizer's grease for the wheels. What they really do is they convert sunlight into carbohydrates, into energy, into protein, into however you want to look at it. Starches. Sugars. They make their own living that way. And that's really important to understand. But that means they're extra sensitive to sunlight. And they base their whole existence on how much, many plants base their whole existence on how much sunlight they're getting. And these declining days, as much as the declining temperatures, it's the declining daylight that's encouraging these species now to flower, to produce a ton of flowers. And there's a bunch of them out there. We're going to talk a little bit about that. We're going to talk a little bit about where to go and how to get there. And how to get some of these native plants, how we can do a better job ourselves doing that as the morning goes on. Dan is asking me, and I wanted to follow up, is this a great time to plant things? Is it a good time to plant bulbs? Sure. Yes, absolutely. If you've got the bulbs now, go ahead and plant them. There's no harm in doing that. Ideally, those bulbs would not have roots on them. So if you've got spider lilies right now, they're going to have roots on them because they're responding to, I can't quite figure out how they figure it out, but they're going to be putting roots on. So it's not a great time to plant them. They really need to be planted in spring. That's kind of weird. That's kind of bizarre, but that's the way it works. They bloom in fall, but they really need to be planted in spring. If you've got bulbs that need to be planted in that bloom in spring, you need to be planting them now. Is it a good time to plant garlic? Yes. I think along the Gulf Coast, it definitely can be. You can clip those garlic leaves all during fall, which is kind of nice. The garlic leaves themselves are really, really kind of good. So as soon as you get the garlic, yeah, go ahead and plant it. Bulbs, yes. If they're, yep. Yeah, so he bought some Lycoris bulbs with no roots. Yeah, you got to go ahead and put them in the ground now. It won't matter. You'll be fine. You'll be fine. You'll be fine. David Hubble. Welcome back to the show, David. Good to have you on this morning.
Hey, how are you?
So, David, you saw I've been setting you up on the whole show to talk a little bit about what's happening this time of year with sunlight and what that encourages. And I said it encourages lots of wildflowers, but there's a whole group of these sort of subtropical plants in this Caribbean zone that bloom in response to day length. And what's one of those plants, David?
Well, it's probably my favorite thing to grow is the melitón, M-I-R-L-I-T-O-N, also known to folks around, I guess, as chayote squash.
Yeah, absolutely. And David has kind of become the expert. Not kind of, he is the expert for the Gulf Coast. And he's got his own, we got melitón.org, merliton.org. which is a site that he's operating and really is working to reintroduce Mélenchon culture in the best sense.
Yeah, I can't
to the Gulf Coast.
I mean, a lot of it goes back to early work done by Dr. Lance Hill out of New Orleans. He set up Mélenchon.org after Katrina when he was trying to locate some of the local heirloom varieties, and he couldn't find them. And he realized we were losing a, maybe not a native, but an heirloom source of plants that have been thriving along the Gulf Coast for nearly 200 years at that point. And so he set that up, and he's been working diligently over the years finding and classifying various heirlooms. Many were lost in New Orleans due to the floodwaters, but luckily many folks throughout South Louisiana had collected them, and the Gulf Coast even, and he was able to start finding homes for them and finding sources. So kind of like you're talking about finding those native seeds, he was able to find people who are still growing them for many generations. And he set up the website, and I came on about 4 or 5 years ago when I started getting mine and started growing and getting a little more experience. And so I've been really trying to help him out a lot in the last 3 or 4 years, and we've set up a Mélenchon.org Facebook page to go with his website. So it's been growing pretty good. We've got like 1,200 members so far.
Yeah, and it's this great tradition, and so if you go to New Orleans, you see how many ways that Mélenchon is used in cuisine here along the Gulf Coast, and New Orleans is sort of the stalwart Caribbean city of the Gulf Coast. Mobile used to be a very Caribbean city. It was in many ways the most Caribbean of all of the all of the Gulf Coast cities. We've lost a little bit of that, and we've lost that heritage. Part of that heritage were things like Mélenchon. But, you know, we talked to David earlier, and I want to emphasize this. We talked about even if you have the same species of plants, like mountain laurel. Mountain laurel from the mountains doesn't do well here. Mountain laurel from Baldwin and Mobile County does really well. It's kind of the same with Mélenchon, too, isn't it? Even though it's a Caribbean plant. Talk a little bit about that.
Okay, so as I mentioned, one of the things that they found is after they were trying to reestablish Mélenchon vines after Katrina in New Orleans, a lot of times some of the farmers were just simply going and getting the what's described as Mélenchon or chayote squash from the grocery stores, and they planted them, and they make these beautiful vines. They look the same. Leaves are pretty similar. But around this time of year, when you start to see the flowers, they weren't seeing any flowers. And what ended up happening is that if they did flower, it would be almost November, end of November, and the first freeze would come. And come to find out, those varieties are mostly from Latin American countries, Mexico, and what ends up happening is that they are a different variety, and so they're growing up like 4,000 feet up on mountainsides, and the days, like you talked about, they're photoperiodic, so they still have longer daylight down there than we have. So they don't start getting those shorter days till later in the year. And so what consequently would happen is that we hit freezing conditions with those. And so that's why Dr. Hill had such a burning desire to find those heirlooms, because they had been adapted well or had been brought over with some of the Haitian migration in the 1800s. And they become such a staple. And so that's what a lot of people make mistakes when they try to grow them, is they try to get them from the grocery store. Even though some grocery stores say they sell local produce, if you look closely at them, you'll look at the sticker and you'll see it's not local to the Gulf Coast.
Yeah. And so that's really important. I mean, and the basics are you can't go to a grocery store and get a Mélenchon off the shelf, because they've been grown in the Yucatan and other places. And they're not as well adapted. You know, one of the interesting things to think about is why would there be a mechanism in a plant, and I won't dwell on this too long, David, but why would there be a mechanism in a plant that blooms in response to shorter days, particularly in tropical conditions? And one of the, so there's not as much difference in day length in the tropics. It's only varies just like sometimes by minutes in some parts of the tropics. In the subtropics, it varies only by about an hour or two either way. Very, very little difference in day length. But what that shortening day length might represent, particularly in some mountain areas, is that the season of, is that it might be the season of in a wet climate, it may be a season that's drier, and that means it's actually easier to find pollinators. In dry conditions, it may be the season when you finally get a little rainfall, which means that the plant can support fruit a little better. So what it's signaling is a change in conditions, and that change is different in different parts of the world. So you want to be able to get plants that are well adapted to the change of conditions in the upper Caribbean, upper Gulf Coast. Hey, we're going to come back here. I think I'm hearing the music in the background. Yeah. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, we're going to be back here. We're going to talking to David Hubble. We're talking about lots of interesting things this morning, so stay tuned. I want to get to a couple of questions real quick just to clarify Michael's question about the little white flower. Spanish needles is another good name for that, and you'll see why. That little white flower you sent me a picture of, it's not native, actually. I think we're more and more we understand that little white Spanish needles is really native to the tropics, but it shows up quite a lot in yards along the Gulf Coast. I would get rid of it. You probably will never fully get rid of it once you've got it in your yard, but those little flowers, and get them now, get them quick, because boy, do they can be a big problem. Spanish needles, you'll understand why. You'll understand. A lot of people are asking me, can we transplant spider lilies? Can we transplant the red spider lilies, the Lycoris now? You can do anything you want, but if you want them to bloom, you wouldn't do it now. I always recommend that people put a little flag there or some little marker where they bloomed, and you'll see that soon the leaves will come out. You'll suddenly get a bunch of leaves, and you'll see them coming out. They'll overwinter, but the roots are already forming, and if you pull them up now, you're going to delay the bloom for at least a year or two. So I recommend digging them up in April and May when the leaves die down, planting them then and in the new place, and boom, you're going to have great bloom even the first fall. So just something to think about. Just something to think about while you're doing that. Barry asked, was there some confusion going on? I don't see any confusion there. It's blooming at just the right time. The leaves next to it are not leaves of Lycoris. So there you go. David, let's get back to some questions. So anything, you had bloom a little bit earlier this year on your melaton, right?
Yes.
And why?
Yeah, so typically what we've said is that the blooms would appear around September 21st, and you start seeing the male buds, and then the female flowers will start to come out. And the difference is that much like other squash, the female flower has a tiny melaton with a flower on the end of it, and then the males are just a white flower with a little yellow in between. So what I've noticed about 2 weeks ago, or a week ago actually, is that I started seeing the flower buds forming. And so my plant's 12, 13 years old, and I was able to start seeing that I've got both starting. So that's a good sign that I'm on the right track. Talking to other people on the melaton.org Facebook page, we found that that's also being seen in parts of Louisiana as well. So we believe that with the lack of hurricanes this year, a lot of plants had a good opportunity to grow, and in certain areas You know, there may be certain sub, like in my backyard, it's probably a little more shady, so that might have helped spur it on as well. But so far, it's been pretty good. We're looking forward to having some good Melitol crops this year.
Yeah, you know, it's also interesting, and we've got a lot to talk about, and I don't know if we're going to get to all of it today, but I do want to talk about Melitol, because, David, the more we select, the more we grow Melitol, the more we're actually selecting for plants, even if we don't think about it. We're selecting for plants that do well along the Gulf Coast, because you're going to the plants that there's a little bit of genetic drift that's occurring even in clones. And we're inevitably selecting for the plants that are producing their fruits earliest and that flower earlier, because they're the ones that survive every year. So we're actually probably doing a pretty good job of selecting more and more for clones that don't need as much, that don't need as short a day. The more we grow Melitol along the Gulf Coast. So you may actually begin, I don't know if we selected enough yet, but I think you may be onto a strain that may be blooming earlier. So it'll be interesting to see if it's a consistently early bloomer or if it is just yearly conditions that cause it to bloom early. But we're probably influencing that as we move along. The more we grow Melitol, the better it's going to be adapted to the daylight and winter conditions here.
Yep, that's what we're hoping for. Yeah. I put my finger out on the pulse of seeing how the other varieties are doing. The white Israel Thibodeau ones that we were growing, a lot of the growers seem to be doing well with those. I'm not really keeping up a quarterly update like I did before, because we seem to have achieved a couple of dozen growers. But we have a network out there now, so we know that those varieties are going to come back strong. And so, like I said, we're kind of just developing more networks and getting the message out to them with other ways, like I said, through the Facebook page as well as the internet.
Yeah. And David, give folks real quickly your website and the Melitol.org. Let's spell it out for them literally so that they can follow you and also follow your progress on Melitol.
Okay. Well, I've been doing a weekly update on kind of a video diary of my vine out here. So that's under my David J. Hubbell YouTube page, H-U-B-B-E-L-L. But most of the postings with the scholarly articles can be found at Melitol.org, MIRLITON.ORG. And we have a companion Facebook page spelled the same way, Melitol.org. And so we're trying to do some things, like we even got a little bit of a contest right now to give away an heirloom Melitol for the first 10 people who recreate a recipe that Dr. Hill came up with. It's a creme de Melitol soup. And I made it, and I made a video, and we got it out there. And they don't have to reproduce the whole video of how to make it. We would like people to put together a 30 to 60 second video of their end result. And for this, they can use the chayote squash from the grocery store.
Yeah.
So we're trying to encourage people to taste them who haven't tasted them in a while, because typically this will be the, as you've talked about, with this part time of the year, they come into harvest around Thanksgiving. And so that's what you see on the Thanksgiving and Christmas tables, will be your Melitol casseroles and your stuffed Melitols with shrimp and crab meat.
And... you know, it is sort of, New Orleans has kind of forgotten that tradition, but it probably would always have been in New Orleans and in Mobile, when Mobile was a Caribbean city. It always would have been a treat at Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's. And because Melitol lasts a long time, it keeps pretty well. You could be eating it through the winter. So it's really an important food during the winter. It was the squash of winter, in a sense, wasn't it? It was
right. And the other thing to remind folks, so those who've listened to us probably are familiar with it, but the vine grows 30 to 100 feet, depending on your sunlight conditions, and it can produce up to 100 fruit in a year, in a season, yep. I should say. So if you have a couple of vines, and they last long, and they're pretty prolific under the right conditions, so you can drive yourself crazy eating melitol with all the availabilities when things are going well.
Yeah, that's right. So but it handles pretty well, and if you get 100 fruit, you know, you should give some away to friends to grow,
right.
And because a lot of those fruits are going to start sprouting, which is really good. About what, March, April?
Now, so your fruits will actually sprout. So if I pick one in November, I'll start to see it sprout in about 3 to 4 weeks. About 4 weeks.
Yeah. All right. Good. Hey, we're going to be back with David. We've got one more thing to talk about, if we can squeeze it in this morning. But we welcome your calls. Give us a call back, 251-343-0106.
Have you ever seen peaches grown on a sweet potato vine?
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Samson seems sort of sweaty. The jasmine they smudged their word. Captain, now the ship is
sweaty. All right. Welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. So we have one more interesting conversation this morning, and it's a bizarre one. It's a little bit out of left field. We haven't talked about it before. We're just sort of introducing the subject, and it sort of puts me in mind of a lot of things that we don't know about where we are, and that we've forgotten about where we are. But this is something that used to happen on our rivers, and it happened not only on the Mississippi River, but happened on the Alabama. And I went and tried to look up the number of species, and there's quite a few involved, mm-hmm. But you got really involved. David, how did you get on the subject of river shrimp?
Well, the river shrimp has been kind of this, one of these forgotten or elusive and nostalgic memories of people like my parents who had memories of going up the Mississippi River between Baton Rouge and New Orleans with their grandparents and having many of these little casseroles or butter beans served with this river shrimp, freshwater shrimp. And so they weren't very common, or they were common at one point for the people who lived out there. But as far as when you go to get shrimp nowadays, you're used to either the white or brown royal reds that are either pulled from the Gulf or the salt waters. But these are a kind of a nostalgic memory of a lot of people. And so I've been hearing about them for years, and I've never tasted them yet. I still hope to get some. But that's how I kind of got interested in trying to find out a little bit more about them. But they used to be very plentiful. In fact, you can look in the old newspapers and see them on restaurant menus in New Orleans back in the late 1800s. And but now, I guess since the mid-50s to 60s, they become more of a rare thing. And some people speculate, because of all the industry on the river, that maybe some of that has caused populations of the shrimp to decrease. Or maybe it has to do with the dredging or just the wakes from the huge tankers destroying the sides of the banks of the river where they would normally do the shrimping. And so it's just become a sort of a lost thing where they have these boxes that they're like a 1x2 Cypress box which allows the shrimp to come in, and they capture them. And years ago, they used to catch, you know, eight or ten pounds in these boxes, and now they might be lucky if they get 2 or 3 pounds on a haul. So that's kind of been my interest to find out, you know, if they existed in Mississippi, on the Mississippi River, why can't they resist along the Alabama's rivers?
And they did, in large numbers, and we have lots of records of them. But you sent me an article that had my old friend Paul Hartfield, who taught me a lot about rivers, and Paul was a shrimper, sort of. I think this is his first job. He eventually went to work for Fish and Wildlife and got really interested in all the other life on the Gulf Coast and in rivers. And Paul was just a brilliant guy, and I miss talking to him. But it's interesting that these are big shrimp, aren't they? They're really big shrimp, and I have not tried them either. It is interesting to me that brown shrimp, and people will argue with me and get mad at me for saying it, but brown shrimp, even really fresh brown shrimp, have a distinctive taste that I might call slightly funky. Tastes of iodine, and it's not altogether pleasant. The shrimp that are in more of a freshwater habitat, interestingly, like the white shrimp, which used to be, if you lived in Mobile, and this is another interesting thing, if you lived in Mobile, even in the 40s and 50s, you wouldn't eat brown shrimp. You'd think, in fact, the old legend was that brown shrimp were diseased, that there was a disease that was causing them to discolor. Because everybody was used to white shrimp. You couldn't get anybody to eat anything but white shrimp. And white shrimp had this really, and still does, a very buttery taste that you don't get with a lot of the brown shrimp that people catch farther offshore. So I'm willing to believe, even though I haven't had river shrimp, haven't eaten them, that they were probably really delicious like white shrimp, and maybe as good as or better than many of the brown shrimp and royal reds that we eat now. But we lost them. And why did we lose them? I think Paul would tell me that dredging was a big factor. Maybe industries, maybe boat wakes, but I'll tell you something that's probably much, much bigger is dams and impediments to movement on the river. And they have played a huge, devastating role in losses of lots of species. And on the Alabama River, Claiborne Dam and Miller's Ferry Dam would have played a huge, massive role in the loss not only of species like the Alabama sturgeon and eels and striped bass, which was so important, and things like red horse and lots of other things that moved up and down the river, but also things like freshwater shrimp. And they just, you know, these shrimp, they don't move well unless the current flows at just the right time. And what would happen is the water would flush these shrimp downstream when they're young, and they would develop in the downstream areas. They would breed upstream and then get flushed down. And the dams prevent that from happening in the old familiar ways. And they also close off habitat, so these shrimp can't get to the shallower waters where they used to breed. Where there is lots of vegetation. So that's the big deal, and it affected the Mississippi and the Alabama. So David, what are we going to do about actually trialing some of these freshwater shrimp?
That's a good question. I hadn't gotten that far yet. I just want to try one. but I think I read an article where somebody was trying to do something. I mean, you got shrimp farms. I don't know why they couldn't do something similar with, and maybe they are. I know some of the schools were trying to do some programs to keep them going. Like you said, for those who, you know, if folks would Google Mississippi River shrimp, you would see it looks like a typical shrimp. It is almost like a brown shrimp in color, but it's got two long little pincers like a crawfish. And people describe it tasting very sweet. And in fact, or the meat being sweeter. And in fact, when they talk about boiling them, you don't even have to boil them that long. I mean, you don't have to boil shrimp long to begin with, but they just say maybe just some boiling water, a little salt and lemon, and that's all you really need to flavor it. But I mean, they were maybe, I guess maybe 80 count if you had to come close as far as size, maybe 4 inches longest. But I don't know, that's a good question. I know a lot of people have been concerned and thinking about it for the last several decades of what to do. Right now, these couple of the articles I sent you, the Foles family, brothers and nephews of John Foles, have been fishing them, and they're some of the last remaining fishermen in the Mississippi River. So they're trying to preserve it from that standpoint as well, trying to keep people aware of it.
Yeah,
you know, it's out if anybody has seen any around here, and if they've tried them. I've been, like I said, it would be nice if we could figure out a way to bring them back.
Yeah, so there's plenty of documentation of those shrimp occurring in the Alabama River. I didn't look up the Pascagoula, and it would be interesting because Pascagoula is the Chickasahay. Pascagoula is largely not dammed. And it gets enough of a pulse that it probably a freshwater that it probably is there's probably some good population still left on the Pascagoula River for people who know how to fish with them for them. You know, one of the other interesting things is that our traditional shrimping industry, many of the ways we shrimp can be very destructive to shrimp habitat and to fish habitat as well. But the old fashioned way of catching river shrimp was to use traps, which wasn't devastating to habitat at all because it didn't require the big nets, and you still got a pretty good count. You just had to know when to put them out and how to put them out, and how to design the right trap. So it's really interesting and worth thinking about a lot. One of the things I will say that Nature Conservancy and other folks are working with Fish and Wildlife on ways to restore the Alabama River in a way that we can get those flows up and down the river. I don't think they will be able to take out dams. It won't hurt anybody except the lakeside homeowners if they did, but that probably won't happen. There'll probably be too much of a fuss over that. We'll have to let God take care of that, which he'll do at some point. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the interesting thing is they may be able to come up with other ways to move fish and shrimp up and down the river. And there are some good mechanisms now, I think, even with the dams we have, to move those shrimp if it was something we were thinking about and studying. So I'd like to see us think more about that on the Alabama River. The Mississippi River is a lot harder case,
right?
Because, boy, is it a mess. It's just a mess for a lot of reasons. You know, do they still see them on the Chafalaya?
I don't know. Most of the people I've heard of really fishing it have mostly been around the, like I said, in the river parishes between St. James and St. Charles Parish. But I did find another article that had a map of where they'd been seen. You may have already seen that, which did show them along the Mississippi and Alabama Gulf Coast counties. So
right.
I'll have to look into that. I think most of the harvesting was also done like in May through June. That was the time I think they traditionally would catch them. I was trying to think if there was something else I was going to add to that.
Yeah, we're going to take a break. We're going to be right back. You know, David, we can talk about these river shrimp for a long time.
Oh, I know.
We'll be right back, folks.
Gages off and Donnie goes like a lake from two. Give him a slip and we'll take a sip of that red old Mountain Dew.
Yeah, so That's one of the songs we got to get out of the rotation. We just have to. There's an interesting version of that, the original Caribbean version. But we're getting out of the hot. And I don't know that I ever really wanted to get into it, at least not the song. But there it is. Let's get that one out of here. If we can, if there's a way to do it. Yeah. Hey, so David is back with us, and we've been talking about shrimp, but not shrimp in the normal way. You know, we talked about white shrimp and brown shrimp. I love white shrimp. It's one of my favorites. I think they've now come up with a way of farm raising it, but fresh out of the Gulf, it's just a beautiful thing, and not so much out of the Gulf, but really out of Mobile Bay. And in the old days, we only fished in Mobile Bay. People didn't have big boats that they could go way out in the Gulf. They fished really close to shore. Almost all the shrimp that were captured were white shrimp. If you captured brown shrimp, you thought, ew, what's that? Must be something wrong with these shrimp. And literally, there was just a bias against eating brown shrimp. And I still, David, I'll tell you, I still have that bias. It's just, I don't like brown shrimp as much. White shrimp are great. But river shrimp are sort of like the ultimate white shrimp, I guess. Sort of the ultimate really plump, buttery shrimp, and were really distinctive, and they lived up the river systems. And yes, I do think they were all along these rivers, most of the rivers that had enough of a freshwater pulse, a really big freshwater pulse, and that came from well inland. So some of the coastal rivers like Perdido may not have had them. But I think the Pascagoula was big enough. The Mobile River was big enough. Anything with a big freshwater pulse was going to have these shrimp. The trouble is, as we said in our last section, there have been a lot of changes that we've lost a lot of species for. And the dams made a huge difference. The river control structure that split the Chafalaya and the Mississippi River probably played a huge role in movement of those shrimp, but also in how the pulses of fresh water occurred and moving those shrimp up and down the river. So that's where the problems have occurred. I would be kind of hopeful that we'd still see them on the Chafalaya, but maybe the old river control structure has caused a problem there as well.
Maybe. Now, to your point, you know, one thing I wanted to mention, even though we're calling them Mississippi River shrimp, I think their official name is actually Ohio River shrimp. That's how far, I think that's where they were first discovered back in the 1830s.
Right.
And
right.
So, like you said, they live way up in the northern waters, and they come down to spawn, or after they've spawned to lay their eggs, and then in the brackish water, and then they go back up. So, right, so if you, I guess, look at those, the water infrastructure, rivers that would go deep into the country, I guess the more fresh water you would see, there may be a potential that they were there too.
Yep. No, and it's definitely so. And so the shrimp on the Alabama would have bred in the Cahaba and in the Coosa River. And obviously the Coosa and Tallapoosa got hammered pretty early on. They quit being rivers a long time ago in most important ways. But the Cahaba was still pretty good, and so we were still probably getting those freshwater shrimp up until the 60s and 70s when Miller's Ferry and Claiborne were built. But it just, you know, they've got to move. They've got to move up and down those rivers, and we've stopped things from moving on the rivers, and that's too bad. But I'm hopeful that we can fix that, and it's interesting to know that that a few of those shrimp still survive. What an incredible resource, you know, and we just sort of blindly lost it without thinking about it.
Comment, you know, tying it back to the garden, you know, a lot of what my cousins and ancestors would do, they'd be able to take their boxes and go out to the Mississippi River, collect the shrimp, and then from the garden they'd be able to pull out things like butter beans, make butter beans and shrimp, and that would feed the whole family, or maybe grow their eggplants, the green eggplants like I like, make a casserole, or even you know, if they had some, if you had an early crop of Melitol, you might even be able to have a shrimp and Melitol with the river shrimp.
Yeah, that's right.
So, I mean, right. You know, it was a big staple. It was part of living off the land back then.
Yeah, yeah. And we've kind of lost it, and it's too bad. It's too bad. Mm-hmm. But you know, I'm hopeful. Paul Hartfield's was optimistic about understanding more about these shrimp and how to get them back in the article that you sent. And you know, at some point I might call Paul and just get him to talk about it. Maybe, David, we should come back and let's get Paul Hartfield on the line. Mm-hmm. And we'll let him talk about white shrimp, and he'll know more than we could ever read about. David is, Paul is just a brilliant guy, so we're going to definitely bring back the river shrimp discussion. What a great part of our heritage! What a great part of our foodways, and something we should try to resurrect if we could. It would be really nice to be able to do that. So I'm now putting this on the schedule. David, thank you for making me think about this. It's been really good, really good.
Well, I appreciate it, and I enjoy talking, as always, about Melitol. And like I said, the native foods that are lost and how to maybe regain them. And I'll try to call you back in December and let you know how my cherry bounce experiment's going.
Yeah, that's right. So we did have lots to talk about. We didn't talk about cherry bounce. Is it still progressing?
Oh yeah, I've got them. They're aging right now. If you want to call it a fermenting, one of the two. So early December, I'll start taste testing officially.
Yeah, yeah. Good,
they got a nice red color to them, and they have a very distinct wild cherry smell, and even, like I said, the little bit I did taste, you can really see how it's imparted that to the whiskey.
Right. So David did this with our native black cherry and the classic black cherry bounce that may have most resembled the drink as we had it here along the Gulf Coast and in America before we started getting all of our food out of the grocery store. So it's really an interesting experiment. David, thank you this morning for all your information. Hey, we're going to be back next week. We're closing in, closing out on time. I'm going to see, did you get the message about the spider lilies, folks? This is a beautiful time to watch them bloom. It's the worst time of the year to dig them up. Put a little flag by them. Put a little marker there. Come back in April and May. Dan says he agrees with me that definitely better to move them in spring than it is now. When is spring? Well, late spring, really American summer. April, May is a perfect time to do it. We got lots to talk about that we didn't have time to talk about this morning. Give us a call next week. We'll pick it up again. Good to have you with us. 6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot. Punch. Daylight.